This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. We talked about how kids and teens are being impacted by the pandemic. Many of you pointed to struggles your kids are having with school. Well, it's not just kids who are struggling, it's teachers too. Now imagine being a music teacher in charge of 50 or more kids who are wielding instruments they're just starting out on. It's hard enough to get them to play in unison in person. It's nearly impossible online. Music education changed perhaps more than any other school subject when learning went virtual, and some educators fear cuts may be coming as we ease out of the pandemic. Who gets access to music education? Why is teaching kids how to sing and play instruments important? And how are music teachers getting the job done? With us to talk about it is Samantha Reed. She's the band director at Isaac Litton Middle School in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Sammy.
Hi, good morning.
Also with us is Ken Elpis. He's an associate professor of music education at the University of Maryland, where he also leads a choir. Ken, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And also with us is Oriana Hawley, a student at the Special Music School High School, where she plays viola. It's in New York City's only K-12 school that teaches music as a core subject, and she'll be graduating this year. It's great to have you, Oriana.
Hey, thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
So, Sammy, many of us are probably wondering how in the world you virtually teach an ensemble class like band. So let's start there. How have you managed this year?
Well, our school started this school year virtual, and we actually just came back to school last week and have about 50% of our kids back in the building. So with virtual learning, we were really lucky that we were able to get a program where I could send the students their sheet music. They could, you know, see it on the screen, play it, and get some immediate feedback on, oh, you missed this note, or you sped up, or you slowed down. We, you know, I had them send in videos of themselves, but it was all just individualized. We never got to play together as a group, which was the biggest thing that we were missing.
And what do you lose when you're not able to get the kids to play collectively?
We lose our sense of community. I think that's a huge reason why kids joined the band, was to be a part of this team that works together to put on a great performance at the end of the term. And, you know, they were just stuck at home playing by themselves. It's scary and weird, and we really missed that time together.
Now, Oriana, you attend a unique school where about half of your daily curriculum is music focused. What has the shift to online learning meant for you and your classmates?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a big change. You know, we used to have our core academic classes, you know, math, English, social studies, and science, and then the last part of our day would be entirely music focused, depending on your personal major and what instrument you play and what you're interested in. But now it's kind of turned into like a totally different virtual thing, where we have specialized classes. For example, instead of big orchestra, we have individual classes about performance. And, you know, it's turned a lot more research based in my case. So we actually will look up the lives of composers such as Bach or composers living now. We'll look up like what each individual chord means. We'll discuss it, which is a great thing in its own way. But, you know, I completely agree. We totally lose that community and feeling of being able to play together and experience artistry together, really.
Well, let's listen to what one of you left in our inbox. This came in from Bill, who teaches high school band in Colorado.
The most challenging thing that has changed this year with regard to teaching music education has been a loss of community. We can try and manufacture things that are educational and meaningful for the kids, but the loss of the moment that the music sounds fantastic and everybody in the room just knows it isn't there, and that has been a very challenging thing to overcome. We're looking forward to things easing up so that we can get back to those magical moments again.
Bill, thanks for that message. Ken, what innovations are keeping music education alive right now?
Well, I think, and technologically speaking, some of the stuff Samantha talked to is really widespread. Teachers learning to use technology and leveraging technology for exchanging audio with their students, exchanging video with their students, and getting a sense of being able to provide them feedback. Although I will admit, it's tremendously stressful and tremendously time-consuming for teachers to sort of teach music this way. What they could ordinarily do in their classroom instantaneously, listening to their entire ensemble play, they now have to do, you know, literally 10, 20, 30 times as much time listening to the same excerpt of music from each individual student.
Sammy, as you said, you returned to the classroom recently, and now about half your students are in person, about half are virtual. How does that work, especially with the in-person playing?
It's a lot, to be honest. So the in-person students, we have bell covers that go on the end of their instruments to try to minimize the aerosols that are going out into the air when they play. We also have musician masks, which are really funny and hilarious in middle school, which kind of cover up their nose and mouth, and then they can put their mouthpiece in there when it's time to play. And of course, we're distanced. We have the windows open. We can only play for 30 minutes at a time. So then the air can circulate through the room. And all during all of that, I'm also trying to be on the computer and make sure that the virtual learners are following along, that they have their music, that I sent them the correct link, and that they can, you know, play with us. It's honestly, I'm not an expert in it, and I'm already overwhelmed by it. But I've got to keep them together somehow.
So the masks the students are wearing have slits in it where their mouthpiece goes?
There's like a little flap that you kind of lift up and put your mouthpiece in there and then put it back down when you're not playing.
How do you feel being back in the classroom with students? I mean, I can imagine on one hand, it's great to be in the classroom again, but I also wonder if you're worried.
Yes, it's about equal. I have equal feelings of both of those things. I was really fortunate that I was able to get my first dose of the vaccine right after our first day of school. So if I hadn't been able to get that, I would be way more worried. I just try to keep my distance as much as I can, which is difficult when I just want to go up to them and help them.
Hmm. Ariana, I'm curious how this last year has made you think about your future in music and what you plan to do post high school.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it throws everything off a lot. And I think a lot of my friends and a lot of people I know had a really difficult time transitioning into, because we're all online, except for selected, you know, small music groups like quartets. I'm in a string quartet and we're able to meet in person. But I mean, honestly, I went through a total kind of like change in how I was thinking about music. I've been playing music since I was about 3 years old. I played violin for a long time and now I play the viola, and I kind of, you know, I mean, it throws everything off, and you have to think about what music and art actually mean to you. And so I've had a lot of those conversations with my friends, with my parents, with myself, honestly. And I mean, you know, it creates such a connection for so many people. And it does so much, especially for young people who are, you know, going through each of their own things, but then discovering the world in a creative, beautiful, colorful way. And I think that's really, really important. And I think that's something that I want to continue doing. And I'm going to college next year, and I'm not going for music necessarily to major in, but I do want to keep playing music. And I've realized throughout the pandemic that I think it's essential for all of us as individual human beings, essential for me as a person. And, you know, it's really important. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been able to play a couple concerts online, and of course, it's just not the same. And then the other day, I was able to play a concert semi on the street, which is completely different. And even though, you know, I mean, most classical music concerts, you're buying $4 million tickets and going to see, you know, highly practiced, highly curated concert and playing on the street, playing songs, playing, you know, varied stuff, you get a totally different connection and people stop to see you play and stop to talk to you and say, you know, thank you so much for this music. I needed this today. And I think that's a really amazing thing.
Well, we got this message from Janessa on Facebook who says, my husband is a music teacher in Massachusetts where indoor singing hasn't been permitted, but sports are, go figure. He's replaced his chorus classes with a course called Hip Hop and Social Justice. I hear him prepping for class and listen in occasionally. What he's teaching is important, and he's using these difficult times to look at hip hop and how Black history has influenced music. We also heard from Kristen on Facebook who says, music education and all the arts are crucial toward development of critical thinking. They nurture the part of the brain which fosters creative thinking, which is crucial for future problem solving. Our priorities are skewed. America is leaning drastically towards STEM over STEAM to our future detriment. We're talking about what the pandemic has meant for K through 12 music education.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Hint, fruit-infused water with no calories or sweeteners. Hint water comes in over 25 flavors. The watermelon water actually tastes like watermelon. The blackberry water tastes like blackberries. Hint is water with a touch of true fruit flavor. You can get Hint water at stores, or you can have it delivered directly to your door. When you buy two cases, you'll get a third case free and free shipping. Visit drinkhint.com and use promo code NPR at checkout.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
Students are slowly returning to classrooms nationwide, but will school be the same as when they left? Some administrators are facing budget cuts and being forced to make tough decisions about what should stay and what should go. The arts tend to be some of the first things on the chopping block, but some of you wanted us to know how important music education was to your life.
My name's Keenan, and I'm calling from Denver, Colorado.
My name is Abby, and I am calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Learning how to play an instrument has been the best thing that I've ever done for myself.
I played violin from age 3 to about 12, maybe 15. I really think that it's helped me with problem solving. I think it's helped me to be adaptable. It's also given me such a creative outlook that I've integrated into my daily practice as an occupational therapist.
My small business has sort of crashed and burned under the pressure of the pandemic and motherhood and childcare. And I can still pick up my guitar and play it and feel a sense of joy and pride about something all these years later.
Although as a child, it might have been a little more frustrating than I would have liked, I do think it also taught me stamina and determination as well.
Keenan, Abby, thanks for those messages. Ken, there's been a lot of research into the value of music education over the past few decades. Can you just try to summarize it for us? What do we know about how learning music helps kids?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the common arguments in favor of school music is this notion that music makes you smarter. And while there are many benefits to music, that particular one might actually be more due to the wealth gap that we see between kids who are afforded the opportunity to study music in schools and kids who do not have that opportunity. There is this inequity and inequality that seems to be persistent when you look at national data. But even though that access to music education is uneven, even when you account for those differences, we do see that music education is valuable for human development. It helps kids understand their own emotional, social, and cultural worlds in unique ways. And while it may not make them better at school, it certainly makes school better for them.
Do we have any idea if some of the benefits still apply when music education is happening remotely?
So that's a brand new area of inquiry. You know, remote music education wasn't really a thing before, you know, about 365 days ago, give or take. So I think there are a lot of my colleagues that are looking at those, sort of how remote learning has changed music teaching and learning for students. We won't know in a research basis, you know, what the kind of net impact of that is, other than the stories that we have anecdotally, which are that, you know, kids don't love remote learning. I think if we've learned anything from the pandemic, it's that the value of in-person teaching, in-person connection is supremely important to students. And I think music teachers are trying to really bring those benefits of making school a better place to the remote world for students now.
When you talk about music education making school better for kids, unpack that a bit for us.
Sure. I'm talking specifically about what psychologists would call school engagement. So one of the things that we know is that when students are engaged in school behaviorally, meaning they are, doing the things that school offers them besides their academics, connecting with peers, connecting with important, influential, non-parental adults, doing clubs, doing activities, learning in the arts, they tend to do better at school because they're more excited about showing up at school every day. And in some cases, it makes that motivation carries over into their academics as well.
Well, we got this message from Penny on Twitter who says, I truly believe band class saved my daughter's life. She became severely depressed and suicidal in sixth grade. We sought help in mental health, but what really helped her was when she joined band and started playing the clarinet. It put a spark back in her. I can't explain. Sammy, exactly a year ago, Nashville was hit with a tornado that sent kids home for 4 days. They were back for less than a week of classes before school went remote because of COVID. And this all happened as you were preparing your students for a big concert. Tell us that story and what lesson you took away from that experience.
Yes. So I had what we called the Honor Band, which was an auditioned group where kids would come in and we had extra rehearsals before and after school to prepare for this big concert in March. And it was not just a concert, it was a field trip too. So that was super exciting for the kids. And like you said, we missed 4 days of school for the tornado and came back the next week, and our concert was going to be on Thursday. So we had to rush and, you know, try and make up for our lost time and polish our performance. And the day before the concert, we, you know, took our instruments home and we talked about, okay, we're going to get here early tomorrow to get on the bus. And that night at about 9 p.m., our school district closed for COVID. So we were not able to go to our concert. And it was almost like going through the stages of grief. For me and the students, and, you know, just having to process the loss of this thing we had been working toward. But when I talked to the kids about what they missed about school, none of them said they missed the concerts. Mm-hmm. No one missed the performances. Everyone missed walking into the band room and having music playing and dancing to it and just being together and working towards our goal, learning together, laughing together. So we kind of had to process that, okay, we shouldn't put as much stock into our few performances a year. The most important thing is being together every day.
Oriana, you know, you talked about you know, rehearsals and performance, but I'm curious from your perspective, what is that social part of playing and you know, engaging with other students around music?
I mean, you know, it's the best thing in the world. Like, you have this incredible connection with your peers, and especially at an all music or all arts high school, you all have this desire to create and express yourself through something that's, you know, words, but also something that's so versatile and something that's so individual to each person. And you really get to know someone through their music. You can talk to someone, you can, you know, we all look at nonverbal signals, but then you hear someone play their music and you see them in their element, you see, and you're able to connect through that. I mean, when rehearsing chamber music, you know, small group music, you have to agree on ideas, you have to disagree, you have to argue with people, you have to cooperate with people, and you really get so close to these people. And all of my closest friends are fellow musicians or artists, and it's amazing. And on a larger level, you know, it lets us connect across all things that separate us in the world, all things that societally separate us. And it's, I mean, I feel like it's the one thing that can actually do that.
Ken, talk a bit more about the research into how music education helps kids' social emotional learning and things like communication skills or teamwork.
Yeah, I think so. Group music making, especially, is an important developmental guidepost for a lot of students. By engaging in a common goal, we've found that group music making promotes literally pro-social behaviors. So the desire to work in a group, the desire to communicate with others, In terms of social emotional learning, you know, music educators get into music teaching to help kids come to understand themselves and their worlds through the art of music. And that art is highly emotional, highly aesthetic. And I find, even in my own teaching when I was a high school teacher, that a lot of kids can sort of learn to process their own inner emotions through the music that they're learning, because that music tends to put that emotion at a safe distance. They can kind of engage with whether the song makes them feel or what emotion it evokes as being external to them, kind of process that, internalize it, and then communicate it as an artist, which really does help emotionally balance one.
Sammy, what led you to this occupation?
I was in band in school. My parents were huge football fans, and, you know, I wasn't going to play football, so I had to find some way to be involved with that. And in a small town, of course, football is the number one event. And so I chose the marching band. So I joined when I was about 11. I had amazing band directors, and like we've been talking about, it was just that community that I always had friends. The first day of high school, I walked in and I had a built-in group of, you know, 200 friends. So that was it for me. And I decided I wanted to do this when I was 15. And it's been even better than I could have imagined.
Well, and I'm also curious in listening to Ken talk about the social emotional learning, whether perhaps, you know, as a music teacher, you're in a unique position to help kids process some of what's been happening during the pandemic, because we know a lot of kids are struggling.
Yes. And, you know, the other great thing is that I see the same students every year. So I have them from fifth grade until eighth grade. So the current eighth graders, we have, you know, established relationships. And so even during virtual learning, we were able to slow down our learning process and focus on those social emotional learning moments, to take a moment, okay, you know, let's pause here and let's talk about what's going on. Or is everyone doing okay? Do you have what you need? I was able to do that with my classes instead of constantly pushing them to learn the next thing like they were in other classes.
Ariana, what's ahead for you?
Well, I was recently accepted into Columbia University.
Congratulations.
Which is really amazing. And I'm hoping to maybe major in creative writing, film, and do still a lot of music, and to hopefully somehow, you know, impact the world in a positive way and make the change that I think is necessary and that I think we all need, and to connect people. Yeah, basically.
That's Ariana Hawley. She's a violist who attends Special Music School High School in New York City. Ariana, thanks so much for talking to us, and good luck on your studies.
Thank you so much.
And I want to bring another voice into the conversation. With us now is Jamie Casper, the director of the Arts Education Partnership. That's a network of organizations dedicated to advancing arts education. Hi, Jamie. Welcome to 1A.
Hi, Jen. Thanks so much for having me.
Emily tweeted, "My younger son is missing out on junior high jazz band this year and is playing his trumpet with a bell cover in concert band. Proud of the creativity of my elder son's high school band instructors, who started the year teaching ukulele and bucket drums as alternatives to wind instruments." Linda tweets, "It's not just orchestras. Singers and choruses are suffering too. Please don't ignore them." Now, Jamie, the arts and music are included as part of the definition of a well-rounded education in the Every Student Succeeds Act. This bill was signed into law in 2015 and governs national K-12 public education policy. But what does that mean in practice? Because not all kids at public schools have access to music education.
Yeah, well, you know, the authority for decision making in education primarily rests at the state level. And so while there is federal legislation that, you know, outlines the broad strokes and then provides funding, that funding goes to states, who then decide what that means. And in many states, like Pennsylvania, where I live, decision making gets pushed further down to the local level. So Pennsylvania, for example, has 500 school districts. Each school district has its own elected school board, and they are responsible for making the decisions for their districts. So, you know, the things that we've been seeing, the Department of Education has a COVID handbook that they released just a couple of weeks ago, And they have language in there that urges schools, so this is at the local level, to prioritize in-person learning over in-person extracurricular and athletic programs and activities, for example, and then also uses that well-rounded education and says that schools should aim to continue to offer music, performing arts, physical education, health education, et cetera, as part of a well-rounded education. The issue is we don't see it happening everywhere. And, you know, there are lots of different reasons for that. We really started to see this in the early 2000s when No Child Left Behind became the federal education law and really placed emphasis on those tested content areas. The arts were not among those. And so we perceived there to be a difference in the importance of tested content areas and non-tested content areas like the arts.
Ken, you mentioned a bit about which kids in America have access to music education and which ones don't. Talk about that a bit more in this context.
Yeah, so I've actually done a fair amount of research on that. In the No Child Left Behind era specifically, some of my own research looking at national high school transcript data from the National Center for Education Statistics that they release as part of the nation's report card, you can sort of track the trend of elective uptake in music before, during, and after the No Child Left Behind era. And what you see is that overall, it looks like about the same number of kids take high school in music. So about one-third, 34% of high schoolers elect at least 1 year of music education in high school. And that persisted through No Child Left Behind. But what you have to remember about No Child Left Behind was its main sort of theory of action was around disaggregating data by subgroups. And when you dig down into that data and you look at those targeted subgroups in No Child Left Behind, students with IEPs, so those are students who are eligible for special education services, English language learners, and students who are of Hispanic, Latino, Latinx origin, they were actually represented less in music programs in the No Child Left Behind era than they were before. And that decreasing trend is quite possible due to increased testing requirements, increased remediation requirements that prevented those students from being able to engage with the arts.
Sammy, you teach special needs students. What have you found music class offers them?
The great thing about the performing arts class for special needs students is that we are all starting from square one. Everyone in fifth grade band is a beginner. And so, you know, we're all on a pretty level playing field, learning, you know, completely new things. So I think that that gives them a sense of, you know, community that they don't feel, maybe don't feel as behind as, you know, they might in other classes. And just the, as we've been saying, the community, having all the students there learning together is really special for those students.
Livy in D.C. says, I'm appalled and frustrated when I hear music, art, or even recess referred to as extras. Decisions about education are being made by people who apparently have not spent time with children and have no idea how they learn. You can put children on meds, seat them at tables or in front of a screen, and put number two pencils in their hands for the long school day. But those children will learn little without the involvement of all their senses, without movement, and without fun. We're talking about music education. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
When the survivors of a mass shooting at a newspaper went back to work, everything was different, even email.
What if someone's sending us more death threats? Or what if somebody sends me a death threat and I don't see it, and then somebody comes and kills all my friends and it's my fault because I didn't read the email?
That's this week on the Capital Gazette series from NPR's Embedded.
Now let's get back to our conversation on music education. We got this message in our inbox. It's from Elise. She's a teaching artist with the Lyric Opera of Chicago, which brings arts education to Chicago public schools. They've shifted to virtual programming in the last year.
As you can imagine, a little challenging to get young people to sing and dance and explore their voices and their own creativity, potentially just a couple feet from their family members. But hopefully we are bringing a little bit of light and diversity, a chance to learn in a slightly different way, or at least an excuse to get out of their chairs or bed or wherever they may be and be a little goofy.
And another one of you wanted to give a shout out to the Miami Music Project in Florida.
They've done an unbelievable job over the years of offering music education and instruction and ensemble experience to kids in underserved communities. And they've continued to do so throughout the pandemic. They've been very nimble and very flexible. They're really something.
Ken, talk about the work community organizations are doing to fill in the gaps in music education.
So in places like Chicago, where the arts education is very uneven from school to school, you do actually see a lot of community organizations. My favorite one being a choir director, of course, is the Chicago Children's Chorus, which is, yes, one sort of small choir that does a lot of touring in non-pandemic times, but it actually is made up more of many neighborhood choirs that have home bases in elementary schools throughout the city of Chicago, providing music education experiences for students who might not otherwise have them. And we see sort of miniature versions of that or maximum versions of that in many other communities throughout the country.
Now, Sammy, around half the students at your school come from lower income families and are eligible for free or reduced price lunch. You say music education is particularly important to them. Why is that?
We're fortunate in Nashville, speaking of the community organizations, that we are partnered with several different organizations, including the Country Music Association. And so we are able to provide instruments to students who would not be able to rent or purchase their own instrument. So it is possible for students at my school to participate at no cost at all. We're able to provide any instrument needs or supplies that they need. So it doesn't matter who is, you know, has a certain economic status. Anyone can be a part of the music program.
Jamie, how well-funded is music education nationwide? I know it varies from state to state, but do we have a sense of whether music education is being slashed or invested in on the whole?
Yeah, we don't. And that's one of the big gaps that we have right now. And it's really becoming apparent at this moment in time. I think Ken mentioned a little bit earlier, we do have some data probably from 2016 and earlier about, you know, the status of arts education generally in schools across the country. And we don't have it any more current than that. And it's also not robust. Some states have those data, but they don't have it across every state, and the data that are reported and collected across states is not the same. The same goes for funding. The issue that we have with tracking funding in arts education is that very few school districts have a line item in their budget that says, this is what we spend on arts education. It's wrapped up into the biggest cost for school districts, which is staffing. You know, music teachers, art teachers, dance teachers, theater teachers are wrapped up in that line item in their budget. And the same thing with materials. So Sammy was mentioning instruments. When schools spend money on instruments, they usually don't have a line item for instruments. It is wrapped into a larger materials cost. Where we might be able to track those, and this would be very labor intensive, but would be individual school board minutes from across the country, where we see exactly what those decisions are by the authority that has the ability to make those decisions.
We got this email from Susan in Oak Park, Illinois. She says, as a parent of two fourth graders in a school district known for its award-winning music education programs, the return to school has resulted in significant cuts to music education. Kids who used to have an hour plus a week of music classes now only have 20 minutes. Music teachers are working as teaching assistants. I hope things will change next year, but I'm not confident. Sammy, has budgeting for music been a challenge at your school?
At my school, I'm really fortunate that I've been able to come back and teach only the band students, but there are neighboring schools within my district and in other districts where, you know, when the kids came back to school, you have a certain number of kids who are coming and a certain number of teachers. Maybe there aren't that many band students returning, so the band teacher can't teach band. They have to teach something else, just so that they can have more kids in their room. So we're really concerned about what that's going to mean for the next several years, because we're seeing a reduced enrollment in music programs after virtual learning. So will our music teachers and any art teacher be able to keep their position teaching their art form?
Now, Ken, one way we see schools closing the gap in music education funding is through parent groups. What did your research find out about that?
Yeah, I conducted a study with a colleague of mine, Dr. Adam Grzay, who's also at the University of Maryland, and we looked at IRS data from the nonprofit returns of music parents groups, which we identified from using sophisticated methods from a large list of organizations that are eligible as 501c3s. And what we find is that rather than sort of reducing inequality, we concluded that probably parents' organizations were exacerbating inequality, because the biggest predictor of how much money a music parents' organization would raise in any one year was the median income of the zip code where that organization was registered. So essentially, you have, again, wealthy parents who want music education for their kids because they understand the benefits of it and are also willing to fund it on top of whatever they're already paying in taxes to support their schools.
So, Jamie, what does that mean for schools where parents are either unable to get involved or don't have the money to donate?
Yeah, well, you know, there are different funding formulas in every state. Some states have shifted the burden from the local level to the state level, and the hope is that that would even out any disparities among individual school districts where they primarily fund education through local property taxes. And in those states, for example, it's not the residential property taxes that are the primary funder, it is the business taxes on property, and so that really creates an uneven blanket of funding across states. You know, those funding models that have shifted funding from the local level to the state level are still experiencing some of the same issues and some new ones. So I think the short answer is we haven't figured it out yet. We haven't figured out the way to equitably fund our schools and get rid of so many of those gaps that Ken was mentioning earlier.
Porter Woman on Twitter asks this: are there data linking arts education to the development of empathy? I can't help but tie the decline in arts education funding to a decline in empathy in the U.S. Do we know anything about that, Ken?
We may. It's not my area of expertise, but I do know that besides music education researchers, there's a whole cadre of human development and psychological researchers who are examining relationships between arts and human and child development. So if it's not out there, I'm sure someone will be working on it soon.
Jamie, what about you?
Yeah, we have some of that evidence. One of the products that the Arts Education Partnership maintains is Arts EdSearch. It's our research database. We've got just over 300 studies in there about the effects of arts education. We have a couple that are about empathy. More interesting to me is really the research about both empathy and improving how we interact with others. And that research evidence, as Ken mentioned, is really coming out of the medical community, to the point where multiple medical schools have arts programs as part of their requirements for their students. So, for example, there's a robust visual arts component in one school where they leverage visual arts as a way to train medical professionals in clinical observation. And the hope is to increase their ability to analyze facial features and emotions and other cues to truly see the whole patient. And then other schools are leveraging music in the same way, but leveraging it to teach those medical professionals to listen to what patients are actually saying. Two examples of this: Harvard is doing the work in music, and University of Florida is doing the work in visual arts. So we definitely see a recognition in the medical community of this idea of empathy and improving the way that we actually hear and perceive others.
I'd love to hear from each of you on the issue of budget cuts. Administrators are going to be facing some budget cuts, many of them being forced to make hard decisions about their priorities, especially during and post the pandemic. And we know, you know, nothing is unimportant for kids, but sometimes something has to go. What would you say to those administrators who are making these decisions? Sammy, I'll come to you first.
I would say you've just got to have some patience. Every music director that I've spoken to has had a decline in enrollment because of virtual learning, because it just wasn't the same for kids. So they might have you know, decided to leave their program. But we know that in a few years, we have the tools that it takes to recruit and retain students, and we will get back to our numbers, to our big numbers, our 100-something students in the band. And you've just got to have patience and have faith in what the music programs can do for the students and for the school.
Jamie, what about you?
Yeah, well, you know, I want to give a shout out to a campaign that is currently running, sponsored by the National Coalition for Core Art Standards. It's called Arts Are Education, and it's a public awareness campaign and a campaign to get school districts specifically to sign on to do a list of things over the next year or two. The campaign talks about what we're facing. We're definitely facing budget shortfalls because of revenue losses at the state and local levels. We're facing schools who are really focused on remediation and this idea of learning loss. And then we're facing unique physical safety needs in arts classrooms. You know, these are things like individual art kits because we can't share visual art supplies. You mentioned masks and covers earlier. And then things like upgraded HVAC for dance studios and theaters. And so what this campaign is asking is that school districts continue to fund their arts education programs. One thing we know from past experience is once a program is gone, it is very difficult to get it back because support for that program dies quickly. They ask that we include the arts in remediation and we don't just focus on those tested content areas. And then Sammy mentioned this earlier, but urging school districts to make sure that arts educators are teaching in the discipline they're certified for, that they're not pulled for other things. So those are just a couple of the asks, but I think it really speaks to what we're hoping that school districts will do in the next couple of years.
Ken, I'd love to hear from you as well, especially I know you run a choir, right? And I would imagine that would be one of the hardest forms of art to get back up and running post-pandemic.
Yeah. I do, and it is. I have the great good fortune to be the director of one of the primarily non-music major choirs at the University of Maryland, which I truly enjoy because I'm still working with students who are learning music not as their profession, but as something that really drives them and motivates them sort of avocationally. And for us, you know, we've had the good fortune of even doing remote pandemic choir over Zoom or sometimes over services that try to make the music making a little more synchronous, like Jamulus or Jamkazam. They all have names like that, but they try to reduce the internet latency. You know, what we found is some students have felt so strongly about staying connected to the choir that they enrolled in it this semester, knowing it was going to look similar to last semester, be remote, be virtual. And it really has an important impact for kids and for college students.
That's Ken Alpes, an associate professor of music education at the University of Maryland, Jamie Casper, the director of the Arts Education Partnership, and Samantha Reed, the band director at Isaac Linton Middle School in Nashville, Tennessee. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A.